Evening, everybody. My name's Paul. I'm a compulsive gambler. The date of my last bet was the 8th of November, 2024. After 4.5 years in recovery, living a program, working the 12 steps, and living my life in 10, 11, and 12, after 4.5 years, I placed the first bet. So here I am, approaching 9 months without placing a bet. Back in the program pretty quickly because things got pretty drastic, pretty dreadful, pretty quickly. I mentioned right at the beginning, I do my best to keep my share to gambling as best I can. I'm an alcoholic. I'm an addict, and my clean and sober date is the 10th of March 2020, which was my original gambling free day where that first bet was placed. I'm not going to bore you about my childhood and too much. I'll give you a very quick rundown, an idea of what it is. I was born and bred in London. School was not something that I particularly enjoyed. I came from a very loving house, mum, dad, sister, everything was very, very normal. School was something that I struggled with because it was the sort of first time I remember thinking to myself, I'm not good enough. I'm not good enough, not good enough. I can't do this, can't do this. So it was also the first place where I learned to pull down my masks and pretend to be somebody else. And I quickly realized that bad behavior would get me removed from classrooms. If I was removed from classrooms, I didn't have to do the work. I couldn't be found out that I wasn't good enough or clever enough or bright enough to be able to do it. So I spent an awful lot of school outside of classrooms. I also spent an awful lot of my school time in the toilets with pockets full of change, throwing it up against walls with other kids trying to get all of their money off of them. I had an attraction to money. Bad relationship towards money at a very young age. But to the point, if I was playing sort of like coins up the wall, I'd be looking for the people that had the biggest denomination. So at that time, the 50 pence piece, because we still had a green £1 note at that time. I think the pound coin was just coming in. But I would aim for the people with the 50 pence pieces. I'd then be looking for the people for the 20 pence pieces and then 10 pence pieces. And I would throw every single coin I had in my pocket until I either had everybody else's money in my pocket or had none myself. And even if I got to that point where I lost everything that day and I didn't have any of the money, I would go home and I would steal from my parents' pots and things like that, and I would get more change, and I would go and I would do exactly the same thing the next day. And I would repeatedly do that. I was the sort of kid that would break into the school, rob the school tuck shop of its chocolate and crisps and drinks, and then turn up on a Monday, and in the school's playground, I would then sell their property to the kids in the playground for less than they would be getting it from the tuck shop. So I'd found a way where I'd found a way towards money, and I didn't do too much legitimately at that time to get hold of it. I would, beg, borrow, steal to get hold of it. What did I want it for? I don't really know. So anyway, I messed school up. I came out at 16 without any qualifications. By that time, I was gambling with penny up the wall, if you like. I knew how to place a bet because I used to go for my grandfather. At those times, you could sort of like send a grandchild round to a betting office with a note, please let my grandson place this bet for me. Everyone knew who everyone was. And I was drinking. From a very young age, I was smoking dope. And I was also taking ecstasy at raves and things like that at the ripe old age of 16. I'd escalated pretty quickly. And all of these things, all of these things, all of these things were a mask, away from myself, away from feeling me, anything to be anyone else other than me. And I learned how to do that at a very young age because I felt so insignificant in so many different situations. The only places, two places that I can honestly say, and that I've never felt the need to pull my masks down, where I can simply be myself. One of them was on a football pitch when I was younger, because I was quite a good footballer and I felt complete, a soccer pitch, sorry, we're in LA. I belonged there. I felt comfortable there. I didn't feel not good enough because I was good enough to certain extents. And the only other place that I've completely been able to be myself without feeling the need to put a mask down is in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and Gamblers Anonymous. I can sit here and I can speak honestly, openly. I can get vulnerable. I've been known to cry. I will tell you exactly how I feel and I will tell you exactly how it is. Sometimes I can be quite aggressive in my sharing. Sometimes I can be very emotional. But the reason for that is I went to work in London at 16 years of age into a barrister's chambers, and a lawyer's, attorney's office, if you want. And I was a 16-year-old boy in a very big boy's world. And I was very nervous. I was terrified. I'd messed up school. Somebody had done my uncle a favour and given me a job. And it's a job that I still do to this day. I've progressed, obviously, further up the ladder within it. But I found myself in an environment which was heavily surrounded with drinking, with drugs and gambling. First day at work, my boss gave me some money to go and meet with one of the other younger guys in the office. And we went to the pub. I was 16 years of age. You were not allowed to drink till you're 18. I had 3 pints of lager at lunchtime and I was off. And this was my world. I stayed in this world from 16 to 44. And I was a daily drinker. I was a daily cocaine. Well, not daily, but I was a very heavy cocaine user. And I was a progressive gambler. Now, gambling for me started with the penny up the wall, but around London, and this is where it sort of progressed from at 16. I was a boy around men, and I was introduced to casinos. I was working with people who would bet on football, so I would go to the bookies at lunchtime. I would sort of like, you know, go for a few beers after work, and we'd end up in the casino after work. And I remember my first loss. I was about 18, my first big loss. I was 18. I'd just been given a Christmas bonus. I took the whole lot to the casino with me because it was given to me in cash. And this bonus was the equivalent at that time to 1 month's money. I lost the lot. And I'll never forget, because we stayed in London that night. We had a hotel booked. And I will never forget the sleepless night that I had over what I'd done, that I'd lost all this money. I'll never forget it. The worst thing that could have happened to me is I got away with it. In that, I went into work the next day. I explained to them what I'd done and what I needed this money for, because I'd lost my car insurance money. That bonus was to cover my car insurance. They lent me that money and I paid it back to them over however many months until I paid it back. There was no consequence. That sleepless night of fear and sort of like, you know, the shame of it all was resolved by 9 o'clock the next morning. I didn't learn my lesson there, and I continued to progress into gambling. Now, my gambling was very much around football, soccer accumulators. I would bet, you know, sports betting, very much around football. And I was never in great shape. I never used to gamble all of my money at this stage. I never used to lose all of my money because for me, it took effort for me to go and place a bet, because I had to sort of like leave the pub, which I was never fond of doing. And I would have to go to a bookies and I'd have to make an effort to go and get a bet placed. But, you know, if I was passing by one, I'd go in. You know, I was a fairly regular visitor. At the weekends, I'd go and have a couple of football accumulators at the weekends and things like that. My gambling progressed to the levels that it did when smartphones turned up. Because I had the world at my fingers. I had my bank account, I had betting apps, and I had beer, because I would stand in a pub drinking with a bookmaker and a bank in my pocket, and I would sit there gambling the whole time. I would sit at work and gamble all through the day. I would follow the sun around the world gambling. So in the mornings, if it was soccer, we're always on soccer, I would start my day by looking around Australia and China and Japan for football. I would then sort of follow the sun around sort of like times of kickoffs, you know, betting on things like the Indian Pro League football, which I knew nothing about. And it progressed to the point that I just couldn't stop gambling. At some point in this journey, I got married. I had two children. I was an active alcoholic when I got married. My wife was sort of a drinking partner to a point. We had children. She stopped. She changed. I didn't. I carried on. The pressure of it all, the anxiety, you know, the pressure of being a dad, being the breadwinner, all of this sort of stuff, you know, not feeling good enough was always around me, always around me. But I gambled, drank and drugged my way through to 44, where I was then at the end, you know, where my rock bottom came, where I was, you know, I was a daily drinker from 16, but I'd now become a gambler that gambled multiple times a day. I couldn't not be in action. I mean, even to the point that I would have to sort of, like, if I had the facility, I would place a bet through the night to see the result when I woke up. And I was losing everything I had. I would, to the point that my wife would have to, she would have to get hold of my wage. She knew what day I got paid, and she would have to get my wages for the mortgage and the bills before I left the house that day, because there was every chance there was going to be none of it left by the time I got home that night. Anyway, my wife got to the point where she was sick and tired of living in this life. I'd got to the point where I was sick and tired of living in this life, crying in the shower every morning. How did it happen again? I don't want to be doing it. I'm not going to do it anymore. Leave the house 6:30, 6:45 in the morning, first bet placed by 7:00. How am I paying that money back to that person? Where am I going to get this from? What am I going to do? And all of this madness and this hamster wheel that was going on and the spinning of plates, and could only think about gambling, how I was going to gamble, how I was going to get the money to gamble, how I was going to get the money to pay what I owe to people. I was begging, I was borrowing, I was stealing. I was into everybody I knew for financials, telling lies to get it, stealing where I could. My wife telling me that she'd had enough. Enough's enough. I want you out of the house. You know, I hit a rock bottom. And at that time, the rock bottom wasn't even being separated or being removed from her. It was being removed from my children. The thought of not being able to live with my children was just... And these were children that, once I'd paid money at the beginning of the month to my wife and the rest of it was mine, I didn't give a second's thought how they was going to get fed on any given day, because the money that was left in my bank account, that was for me. That was my drink, that was my drugs, that was my gambling. That's my money. You know, I've done what I have to do there. You worried about the rest of it. You know, no concern for their well-being whatsoever. She wants a divorce. I surrender. I hit rock bottom. I spoke to a few people, my sister, my dad, a couple of my best friends, and into rehab I went. I spent 19 days in rehab, and I was supposed to be there for 28 days, but this was in March 2020 and COVID hit. So the rehab centre was closed down after 19 days. And out of rehab, I came into a lockdown, back in my house with my wife, and Zoom became my thing. And I got to meetings, and I got numbers, I got speaking to people. But whilst I was in rehab, I'd gone there to get clean, sober and gamble free for the wrong reason. I'd gone there to try to get my marriage back or to get my opportunity to remain with my children. I'd worked it out after a few days once I'd sobered up a bit that I needed to do this for me, first and foremost for me. The most important thing here is that I have got to want to do this. And I did. I'd wanted to for a long time. I used to pray in the shower, crying to my mum above me, please let this stop. Please make it stop. And I would carry on. I came out to rehab and I got into the meetings and I started meeting some wonderful people who were just like me. They were saying things that were repeating my story. And I began to trust them. And I began to believe that there was something that may be able to change this life that I was living. And one day at a time, I kept coming back because they told me to. And I started working a 12-step recovery program through Alcoholics Anonymous and Gamblers Anonymous. I drank for God knows how long. It never once crossed my mind to end my life. My last night of gambling, I was standing on Blackfriars Bridge without any money whatsoever, and I was thinking it all goes quiet if I just jump into the River Thames. Gambling took me there. Alcohol and drugs couldn't. Gambling did. Gambling did. And I was scared by that, and I never wanted to return back to it, so I keep coming back. And I kept coming back. Noted, 5 minutes. I kept coming back. I got to meetings in person as quickly as they opened. I got service as quickly as I could. I got a sponsor at the time in which I found the right person. And I got on with the steps. And I started working through those steps with another human being. Step four was a bit of a disaster. Stayed there for too long. Lots of people do. I'm not the only one. I wouldn't recommend it. I lived my life within this program for 4.5 years. Lived my life in this program. There's people on this meeting that have seen me. They've been with me. They'll vouch for it. I lived it. I breathed it. I was on my knees with my higher power. I was with my sponsor. I was doing everything that is suggested. I separated from my wife because there was too much muddy water under the bridges. And about 18 months after I separated from my wife, she was diagnosed with cancer. My son is 15, my daughter is 13. And somewhere along that journey of the way that I was feeling, because I act out when I'm uncomfortable, I argued with my higher power. How can there be a God? How has she got cancer? My poor children are going to lose their mother because she's terminally ill. And all I could think about at that time with some of these awkward moments is, I need a drink, I need a drink. So I went to AA, not to drink. And somewhere, somehow, I wasn't thinking of gambling, but I'd heard something in a meeting about GamStop. And my GamStop had gone onwards, so I was in recovery in the rehab centre. So I picked up my phone. I wonder if my GamStop's still on. So I tried to download an app on my phone. A gambling app came onto my phone. That can't be right. I probably can't transfer money into it. I transferred money into it. Money was sitting there in the gambling app. I'm going to place the bet. And I placed that bet. I had 8 days. 8 days of non-stop gambling in a way which I had never gambled before, gambled in numbers I hadn't gambled in before, playing games I hadn't played before. And I destroyed my finances that I'd worked so very hard to repair over the 4.5 years. And I'd done the lot and more and more and more. And I was sitting on a Thursday night about 2 o'clock in the morning when the last bit of money went. And I slammed my laptop down. I slammed my laptop down. And in a rage, I stood up and the thought went through my head, where can I get a bottle of vodka from? And this cunning, baffling, powerful disease that I suffer with, that I have that illness, had got me in to where it wanted me, tricked me, allowed my thinking to believe it was my own. And at that moment where I thought to myself, I want a drink, I knew I had to speak to somebody and admit what I'd done. Because if I started drinking and drugging on top of this gambling, my life would be over. If I relapsed around drink and drugs the way that I relapsed around gambling, I wouldn't be sitting here now. I wouldn't. It would have killed me. And I found the strength and I found the serenity prayer and I found the courage to own it up to a couple of people. One of the first people I told you sitting here in this meeting was my temporary sponsor when I came into recovery. Has been with me on this whole journey, was one of the first people I spoke to. And I got back into these rooms as quickly as I possibly could. Why? Because it works. if you do what is suggested, it works. I get on my knees every morning and I pray to a power greater than myself, a God of my understanding. I speak to other gamblers on a regular basis. I attend meetings. I have service. I have sponsees, although my sponsees at the moment have suffered from me at the moment because I've been having to do a lot of work on myself. I've had to revisit a step 4 and 5 with my sponsor. And whilst we were there, I met for 3 hours. I ended up being there for 6 hours with him because we went through and did another 6 and 7. You know, I take this program very, very seriously because it's a matter of life and death. It keeps me accountable for lots of different reasons, and it keeps me safe. The only thing that has ever been able to stop me gambling is a program of Gamblers Anonymous. I am useless on my own when it comes to gambling or not. I'm great when it comes to gambling. I'm useless when it comes to not. Anybody know? Anybody suffering? Anybody struggling? Give it a go. They said it to me. Give it 90 days. Get 90 meetings in 90 days. I did about 140 in those 90 days because it was all on Zoom because I was in lockdown. But I then revisited my 90 and 90 when it was basically out and 2 meetings. And I got that done as well. I live, I breathe this program. I live in 10, 11 and 12. I do. I have peace. I have serenity. I have spirituality. But the most important thing is I have freedom. I have the freedom from the madness that I lived in for so many years. And I am so aware that the moment I start to argue the program or withdraw from it, I will place a bet again. I said I used to come back because I only had one fear, and the fear of placing a bet. I placed that bet. That fear lives deep inside of me because I know that I am a ill, sick, diseased, compulsive gambler addict. This is my medication and this is what keeps me safe. My name is Paul. I am a compulsive gambler. Thank you for listening to me. I will leave it there.
Thanks so much for that share, Paul. Fantastic. Great having you on here this evening. And we've got a few hands up. So we'll go straight to questions with Emma. Emma's got her hand up.
I'm a compulsive gambler, no gambling, thank God. Yeah, I haven't really got a question. I just wanted to say thanks for your... I didn't really hear the end of your share, but what I heard was when you were just talking about how powerful this illness is, the illness that I suffer from, you know, I'm not... I've got a living problem. Of course, I've got a gambling problem, but I've got a living problem. I ain't got a financial problem, you know. I'm just a stage 4 chronic compulsive gambler with a heroin addict with a needle in the arm when I gamble. And I've been in a chronic relapse. I've been out a million times. And every time I go back, it's always worse. It's longer and worse, you know. And last time I placed a bet, it was just this, any normal bet. It always ends the same and stuff like that. But 2 weeks after that, I started with anxiety and depression, you know, really bad. And I got really poor at the end of the year. Been in some dark place with the gambling, but of course it's related to my gambling. You can't have the highs and the lows of this illness and not affect your body, do you know what I mean? Just because I'm not putting stuff in my body and I'm 14 months clean today and it's a miracle, but I never thought I'd get here. It's not about the days, it's about where I've come from in November to where I am today, you know. First time I've proper looked at myself, working these steps, sat with my own self, no relationship, no gambling. And I'm doing it, you know, a day at a time because this program has given me my life back today. I'm so blessed to be where I am. And some days I still sit in self-pity. You know, I do that on a really often, but I can come out of it very quickly as well. I get the thought to place the bet. The illness still talks to me today, you know. But the thing is, I've got no obsession and I can sit with it and I can share it. I can use the tools and this. I never could do that before. I really couldn't, you know, if I got a thought I were out gambling, that were it. I couldn't see my life without gambling. I messed up so many relationships with my kids and everything. And today, sorry, my boss, I don't know if you can hear that. But today I'm just so grateful to be where I am, you know. And when I heard you share, Paul, it just, you talked about this illness, you know, the rail illness, and very rarely hear people talk about it, the solution, the illness, where it takes you, and how cunning and baffling it is, you know. I'm just grateful today not to be in the madness, and you just reminded me of that. So thank you.
Thanks for that, Cher Emma. I appreciate that. And we'll go to Kim R next.
I'm Kim, compulsive gambler, and I'm on day three today. I'm just coming back. Paul, thanks so much for your share. I admire your dedication and willing to, like, say it's, you know, a deadly disease. But I'm not sure if you use that exact term, but I agree with it. Anyway, my question to you is, do you have a built-in forgetter? And what you did, like a built-in forgetter, you just forget what it was like and you act on an impulse? Or are you doing so much GA all day that it's keeping you away? I will just forget, get so lonely at night that I want to go hang out with those friends. I really don't have new friends is the problem. And I need to get some new friends. But a lot of times I'll just forget, you know, purposely, that the gambling is so strong. But anyway, that's my question.
I can't say that I ever forget. My head talks to me every day. Addiction talks to me every day. I have a constant reminder. For me, it's almost impossible for me to forget, because I get spoken to. There's two voices in my head, right? And I learned this from a very wise man a few years ago. There's two voices that talk to me. There's my own thoughts, and there's addiction talking to me. The problem is they talk to me in the same voice. And it is with the use of this fellowship and the dedication that I put into it and the work that I put in, that the moment I have that bad thought, immediately I hand that over to a power greater than myself, because I'm aware of bad thinking, because I do inventory. I do inventory nearly every night. I look at myself on a daily basis. I can't afford to forget. Now, sometimes I can be going around in my life and I can sort of forget that I'm an alcoholic. I can sometimes forget that I'm a compulsive gambler. I can forget because life's going well and I haven't had bad thinking. And then all of a sudden I get hard reminders, because all of a sudden I can be walking and I spend a lot of time on the beach and in the sea, because I find that very spiritual for me. But in the areas where I go, you know, there's bars and there's sort of like, all of a sudden I can walk past a casino and or I walk past somebody drinking, and think, oh, that looks nice. And the moment I get that thought, that's not a good thought. That to me is bad thinking, and I have to recognize that immediately, because I cannot afford to forget. When I'm going about my business and I'm spiritual and everything's wonderful and I'm working my program and I've got no obsession to do any of it and it's the last thing on my mind, it just takes a little reminder of a little sort of spark in my chair. If I see a casino, all that, like the excitement, it comes to me, it hits me. Bang, it goes away, because I remove that, because I know that I don't want to gamble, so therefore I can't be thinking that that's a good idea. That's addiction trying to tell me that it is, and it's telling it to me in the exact voice I'm speaking to you in now. I hope that was the answer you was looking for.
Yeah, it is. I have a some friends asked me to a game tonight. They just sent me a text. And it's like, you know, I forget why I'm doing this. I forget why it's so important. I just need to get out, get to a meeting. That's why I'm here. But I just keep thinking, oh, it won't hurt. It won't hurt. But it's going to kill me. I don't know why I still do that. But anyway, that's why I'm on day three. Yes, you answered my question. Thank you.
Thank you, Kim.
Thank you so much for that question, Kim. And we don't have any hands up at the moment. Is there anybody else who would like to ask Paul a question or just share anything on their heart and mind? Please feel free to. Oh, Jeremiah.
All right. Thank you. Really powerful share, Paul. You were so direct and so clear, and the insights you have about this disease really hit me. There were so many things that resonated. All the stuff that you were saying about following the sun around the world. I was even placing a lot of money in Indian League, Malaysian League. Whatever I could find. You brought me back there. And this messing up school, not having sense of achievement and stuff like that, I can also relate there. That was also part of it. But I just specifically wanted to ask about you having a bad relationship with money, because I also had that. So if you could just elaborate on that a bit, that bad relationship with money, how did you develop that? Was it upbringing? Was it your low self-worth, or was it something else? And how does that relate to you becoming a compulsive gambler? Thank you.
That's a good question. How does it relate to me becoming a compulsive gambler? Greed and the easy option, or thinking it's the easy way. My bad relationship with money comes from ego, I think, because I wasn't the most intelligent. In my eyes, I wasn't the best looking. I was very down on myself. So to me, money was impressive to people. If I had more money than everybody else, if I could show better clothes, if I had the best trainers, it was about my ego. And this all about, I wanted the money to spend it. I wanted the money to give people this false idea that I was doing really well. And I knew how to get hold of it. I learned at a very young age how to get hold of it. And sort of people sort of took notice of it. So I had to get more, and I had to get more. Greed, right? As well as ego, there is greed. Nothing is ever enough for me, right? And I can show that in behaviors even today, right? I'll go out and get a tattoo. I'm now covered in it. I'll open a tub of ice cream for a bit of ice cream. I'll finish it. Showing addictive traits within ice cream. A packet of sweets, I'll scoff the lot. I own something like 25, 30 pairs of trainers. Why do I need those? I show these behaviors still in different ways, and I have to check and regulate that behavior. Because it's greed. And I know this greed stuff through my six and seven. If anyone talks about the steps, defects of character, and then asking God to humbly asking God to remove them. And I am surrounded by defects of character. I have to ask every day to have these defects removed, because if I can't, they're capable of showing themselves at any time, at any point in any day, regardless of how hard I'm working in recovery. They will choose to, still try to show. And greed is a terrible, terrible defect of mine. It makes me feel safe, money. Having, yeah, there's, since I've been in recovery, it's like, I could spend a month with no money, and I'd find a way. Do you know what I mean? I'd duck and dive, and I'd sort of like, I'd get my way through it. And in addiction, that sort of like insecurity around money didn't bother me because I was so sick. But here I am today in recovery, sort of like spiritual. I don't need anywhere near as much money, but I still do like to have I look at my bank account and know that it's there because it gives me that sort of comfort of security that if something is going to rise itself on me tomorrow, that I'm there and able and capable of looking after it and taking care of it for myself. But I don't need £130 million in there because I no longer need 10 Ferraris and a 37 bedroom house. I don't need to buy Arsenal Football Club to run it into the ground anymore. By the way, I'm a Spurs fan. Nice to see you. It's amazing how we can get on in these rooms, you know? It's ego, it's greed, it's defect of character. But whilst I have control of my defects of character and they're not running wild, my wrongful hunger for money is removed. How that turns me into a compulsive gambler? Was always a lot easier to win a fivefold than it was to go and do a day's work. That's what my head told me. When I used to go, when I go to work and I'd earn my money, I'd get my money. When I gambled, I lost it eventually. Even after I won, I was guaranteed to lose.
Thank you for that answer, and I never thought that I could relate to a Spurs fan like this, but I'm so happy that this answer is recorded because you pointed out so many things that I can relate to, whether it's the insecurity, whether it's feeling less than, having that low self-worth, and like buying relationships with money, doing like legal things to get hold of money and so on. So thanks for your like deep insights. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Thanks a lot for that, Paul. We've got Dan with his hand up now. Dan?
Yes, thank you. And thank you again, Paul. What an amazing, amazing share. And again, I also have to say that I'm so grateful it's being recorded, that there was quite a bit going on in the background. So I wasn't able to listen in fully as I should. But given the right opportunity, having it recorded at my own time, I can go back and listen. But I wanted to ask you a question. You've been around, you've been through quite a bit. And we have members that, you know, like I was when I first came in, struggled quite a bit with the initial, you know, withdrawal symptoms, and the first few months are so difficult. At least they were for me too as well. And I hear a lot from others asking, is there anything that you can say or do to give a little bit of hope? Or what did you do in the first few months? Was it difficult for you? What techniques did you use to, you know, besides the calling someone, you know, doing what we have to do? Is there something else that you did that might be helpful for others? And thanks again for your share.
It was you're very welcome. In those early, it was very simple for me. It was very simple for me. I was so sick and tired. I'd surrendered. I was done. Right. So I was prepared to go to any length to not place a bet. I had the obsession around me still. I was a little bit lucky, I suppose, to an extent, in that I came into recovery right at the beginning of lockdown. So everything, I was shut down. Right. So even though I had the obsession, there was no football being played. There was no, obviously there was online stuff available to me, but my phone had been gam-stopped. So I didn't even look. I didn't try to place a bet, but I'd been shut down. But the obsession was around me, you know, to drink, to drug, and to gamble. The obsession was there, even though I didn't want to, because I would gamble against my own will. You know, I was a gambler that gambled against my own will. Don't place the bet, don't place the bet, and I'd place the bet. So I listened to some wise people. I got onto meetings and I've got numbers and I've got myself connected as quickly as I could. And I knew that that was something that I had to do because I had the advantage of coming into recovery for a rehab centre where I spent 19 days of constant recovery. I needed that because I was in a terrible, terrible state. The big thing that I did to try to keep myself safe for me, when not in a meeting, when not on the phone to somebody, if I wasn't in prayer, when I was just going about my day-to-day stuff and the obsession was around me, the thought of getting through the day was too much. I couldn't bear the thought of having to wait till I was asleep. So I would just break the day. People would say just for today. When just for today is too big a space or too large an amount of time, I'll just break it down into smaller chunks. So if the obsession was on me at 9 o'clock, or if I was in that place at 9 o'clock, I think to myself, right, okay, all you've got to do is get through till 12 o'clock because you're going to jump on a meeting at 12 o'clock. So I think to myself, right, I'm going to do a couple of hours work from 9 until 11. At 11 o'clock, I'm going to go for a walk, and soon it's going to be 12 o'clock. I've just basically tried to keep myself in a place where I was sort of like knowing what I was going to be doing for that chunk of time. And then I'd get to that point, 12 o'clock, I'd do a meeting for an hour, whatever it was. And then all of a sudden, I'd be there. So I'm like, well, you know, I'm still 10 hours away from bedtime sort of feeling. I've got this head going on. Like, okay, well, what are you going to do? And then I would just build my day into smaller chunks and just look. And I'd be watching the clock quite a bit. And it was just a case of, right, okay, you've just achieved another 3 hours. You've just achieved another 3 hours. You've just achieved another. Now you've just achieved a day. And then one day became one day and 5 hours and 10 hours. And it wasn't even one day to 2 days to three. Sometimes I was literally 3 days, 7 hours and 45 seconds sometimes. But I was just breaking the day into smaller chunks. But the big thing as well was having the plan throughout the day, knowing where my meetings were going to be, knowing which ones I was committing to. Finding a higher power, you know, finding a higher power was a changer for me. You know, higher power to me, I didn't share it, but I'll be very quick. Higher power came to me very, very easily. I shared it. I think I mentioned in my share that I was standing in the shower crying, praying for it all to stop to my mum, but my mum's been dead 15 years. You know, she died. I was an addict. She died. She never saw me in recovery. But I used to cry to her in the shower, asking for it to stop. So then when I needed to keep it stop, I knew who I was praying to already. I was just praying for the wrong things. But once I got that connection, that helped me an awful lot because I felt safe. I had accountability to something. There was something far more powerful than myself. You know, if I couldn't do it myself, I put myself in God's hands. You know, I talk about God a lot. I'm not a religious person in any shape or form. But I talk about God. You know, I pray to God. I have a relationship with God of my understanding. You know. My mother, you know, no human power and all that, but this is not a human power. She's dead. It's a spirit above me that sort of like watches over me. But, you know, find your higher power and believe in it and just try it. It can be the sea. It can be a tree. It can be a group of drunks. It can be a group of dickheads, whatever you want it to be. It can be. If you stand accountable to it, it removes bad thinking. It gives you peace of mind, gives you a comfort.
What a beautiful answer.
Yeah. Wow. Early days. And sorry, I will just think.
It's a beautiful answer as well.
But the most important thing, keep it simple. Just keep it simple. Don't overthink it. Don't overcomplicate it. If you don't understand something that's going on in these rooms, ask a question. Get someone's number and then ask, what's this serenity prayer all about? Or like, you know, just, and I asked questions. I wanted to know everything, you know, because I'm obsessive, so I wanted to know everything. I didn't want to look stupid in the room, so I wanted to know what I was talking about and what I was doing as quickly as I possibly could because I didn't want people to think, you know, I didn't want to wear a mask. I wanted to know what I was doing.
That was a great answer. You know, I was looking always at my old sponsors always tell me, you need to get closer to your higher power. You need to let go of your will and have, you know, God's will to take. And but it's that trust that I've always had issues with in my gambling career, you know, and in my life as well. And I was never able to trust anybody. And to, you know, and that is what's holding me back from full surrender. is having the total trust and faith that the higher power is there for me as long as I do my part. I just kept let go and not have that obsession in my mind all the time of this and this and that. So that's a great answer. And also, the other thing would be, you know, I'm also cross-addicted with other illnesses as well. And I find out that after a while, this program in itself, this 12-step program of Gamblers Anonymous, is enough for me to be able to handle my others as well, as long as I'm connected enough. Did you find that as well for you, or do you still connect to, because a lot of us are the same way, you know, cross addicted. You still attend your other meetings as well as this one? You know, because the reason I ask, if I were to go for every addiction I have, I would be at 72 steps a day and 6 months, you know, so. So that's my question there too. And also, did you find it helpful, or did you even use the tool of not having money, turning your money over to somebody else?
Yeah.
Because that's something that, you know.
Yeah, I relieved myself of money in the first instance. I mean, I didn't have any to relieve myself of at the time, to be perfectly honest with you. But, you know, I came out of rehab and I was straight back into work and getting paid. And that money at the time went to my dad, a man that I trust with my life. And I had to ask him for money as and when I needed it. And I mean, we didn't go as far as me showing him receipts for what I was buying, but he trusted me in, I need X amount of pounds because I need to go and get food, or I need, you know, and at that time it was lockdown. So there was very limited things for me to be spending money on. You know, it was literally for food and to pay bills. And he trusted me in what I was doing, which was great. Slowly, I suppose, when I say slowly, probably after about 6 months, I started to feel comfortable in keeping a certain amount of money around me. So I didn't relieve myself of all of it. I would relieve myself of substantial amounts and keep you know, enough money to be able to manage myself through maybe a week or 2 weeks, and I would keep a smaller. So if there was any damage done, it was not going to be catastrophic. It could only be minimal. And I built my own trust up in myself, right? You know, and I earned the trust of people around me. At that time as well, in those early days, right, I was with Matt. He was my temporary sponsor. I'd met him in Bournemouth. He took me to my first GA meeting. And I used to drive him mad because I would run every thought. If I was thinking about buying 5 cola bottles, 5 penny sweets, I'd run it past Matt. Am I being greedy or should I only get 2? It's like I ran everything past. We had a big discussion after a year, you know, about a car that I was buying and all of this sort of stuff. But, you know, I went and sought advice from people the whole time. But then I built up my own trust in myself again because I hated myself. I was ready to die, right? And I was repulsed at my behaviour. And I started loving myself again and I started trusting myself again. And that was a big thing for me, to learn to love myself and to earn my own trust back. The cross addiction, I'm thinking about starting my own meeting of Ben and Jerry's Anonymous because I shovel ice cream down my throat like you can't believe. But I give myself that one. I have to give myself a little bit of something somewhere here, right? I do the same amount of Alcoholics Anonymous as I do Gamblers Anonymous every week. I do 4 or 5 meetings a week. I did my steps with an alcoholic through the Big Blue Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. We did a step for financial inventory through Gamblers Anonymous, but he spoke to somebody to help him be able to take me through a financial inventory through my gambling when we went through the steps. But my recovery has all been molded into one. What I do in the rooms is what I do in the rooms. When I talk about God, I'm talking, which is why I do cross over when I share in a Gamblers Anonymous room. I will cross over into drugs and alcohol. And I apologize for it because it's for gamblers, right? But I'll do exactly the same thing in a room of Alcoholics Anonymous as well. I will talk about my gambling. It's a selfish program, and I am brilliant at being selfish, right? That's my defect of character to die for. Yeah, I'm selfish beyond you. But here, I'm prepared to be selfish as long as I get what I need out of it. But at the same time, I don't forget that I'm doing that. So when the opportunity comes for me to give back, I'll give back in abundance.
Thanks for that. We'll go to Matt now for a question.
Yep. Hi, everybody. Matt, Compulsive Gambler. Last bet was the 5th of November 2014. Yeah, good to be back on this meeting again. And yeah, I didn't realise that Paul was actually sharing this evening until we spoke on the phone. And he told me, and I was like, OK, great. I'll be coming on. So, yeah, it was really, really good to hear the share, Paul. And I don't know where to start, really. I mean, one of the things that you just talked about there was that kind of, you know, that talking about selfishness, and you and I were talking about something earlier, and I won't go into what it was about. But I was saying, you know, we think quite similar. And I think the thing that we were talking about is like, what's in this for me? And I said, you know, I'm not ashamed. I'm not embarrassed to think like that anymore. Do you know what I mean? It's like, it's a natural reaction. Somehow, at times, you know, the program has almost made me go too far in my thinking, yeah. If that makes sense. Oh, I'm not allowed to have that thought because the program doesn't allow it. No, I am. I am allowed to have that thought. That's okay to have that thought today. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. It's that self-awareness that I've got today that I know I'm having that thought. And I'm acknowledging that. And then it goes. And I realise that actually what's in it for me, that's secondary. And then I go to the primary purpose of whatever, you know, what we were talking about earlier. And, you know, I think it's really important to acknowledge these things, that we shouldn't beat ourselves up all the time about having thoughts about things. And, you know, it's quite normal. People who are not in the program, normal people think like that, you know what I mean? And, you know, ever since I've got into this program, I think sometimes I can overthink it. And they do say that this is a simple program for complicated people. And that is where, you know, my overthinking and my complicated thinking centers within me. And so today I try not to beat myself up about those things. And, you know, what you were saying there about when we talked about you buying that car, I remember that. I remember going through that situation amongst lots of other things. But the point that I think you've gone on to make after that was really, really poignant for me, about trusting yourself and your own thinking. Because the program is there for us to have a normal way of thinking and living. And quite often, I don't hear it spoken so much about in GA, but I do hear it in AA, which I'm a member of as well, is talks about intuition. And the program will support you with your intuition. You will intuitively know these things. That's what it says. And that, for me, is about trusting myself. I have that intuition today. I know what's right and what's wrong today. And an example of this was recently, I don't think I've shared this on a meeting before, and probably the reason I haven't shared it before recently on a meeting is because I nipped it in the bud very quickly. So every birthday, my mum gives me some money. She always has done. She always does. She hasn't got a lot of money herself, but she always gives me some money. And particularly since my recovery, she says, just take it out. We have a joint account together where I look after some money. She says, just take it out of that account. And I left her house one day and said, oh, I'll just take that money out of the account for my birthday, shall I? And I just walked out. And I got in the car, started driving. I thought, what are you doing? The way that you've just said that is completely off. So I called her straight away and I said, I'm really sorry how I said that to you. It was really off. And she said, no, I didn't think anything of it. And I said, okay, I just, well, it just didn't sit well with me. That was all, you know, the way that I spoke to you about that. You know, she's 83, you know, and she just, no, she said, no. But I had to check myself very quickly because my intuition told me the way that you've just said that does not sit right with you. And it didn't sit right with me at all. And even though my mum was like, I didn't even think about it, to be honest, it didn't feel right with me. And that was my intuition kicking in, you know. I'm really, you know, I talk about this in meetings a lot. I won't go on much longer, but, you know, Paul, you are, you know, a real inspiration. You know, you got a lot going on in life at the moment. And we were talking on the phone for half an hour today. And, you know, I said this on the meeting on Sunday night on our Bournemouth GA Sunday meeting. You know, I get a lot of strength from other people like yourself. You know, if you're not there on a Sunday, I'm always saying, where's Paul? Do you know what I mean? And, you know, you're one of them people that I want to hear from every week. But particularly with you're so honest with your shares and where you're at. That gives me a lot of strength. Do you know what I mean? You know, we've got somebody who in that Sunday meeting as well who talks a lot about some difficulties they have had in their life recently. And they've been around in the program for a long time, over 35 years. And recently they've had a lot of problems and, you know, challenges in their life. And I know you've got similar things going on. And the inspiration that I get from both of you around that type of stuff is like, that sets me up for the future. I know it does. It helps me with my resilience. I think if I can see other people doing this, I know that I can do it too. You know, doesn't matter how long I've been in the program for, you know, I just feel lucky that I've been here for 10 and a half years. Do you know what I mean? I feel lucky. Maybe it's not all luck. Maybe I have worked a program and I've got stuck into meetings and I've been of service and I've done what I can do. But I do feel some form of luck today that, you know, life has given me a second chance again. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. I didn't feel like I was going to get a second chance. I didn't feel like I deserved one. You and I went through the same rehab centre. You know, we went through the same treatment centre. If it hadn't been for Paul, you know, giving me that place at that rehab centre, I wouldn't be here on this meeting today. I really wouldn't, you know. I really wouldn't. You know, I remember emailing Paul saying, Paul who runs the rehab centre, saying, do you remember me? You know, we spoke 2 years ago, blah, blah, blah. Within 10 minutes, he messaged me saying, get down to Bournemouth. I was like, wow. You know what I mean? If I hadn't taken up that offer, I honestly believe that these things, we come to these crossroads in life and we either go one way or the other. Do you know what I mean? And luckily, you know, I went on this path and then it brought us together and we've become good friends. We've become close friends, you know. We don't talk every day, but we talk, you know, regularly enough. We check in with each other and, you know, I was blessed, you know, like when you phoned me and you said to me what had happened and I said, just get back on a meeting. Do you know what I mean? And I know, Paul, that you would do the same for me. I know you would be straight on the phone saying, you just need to get straight back on that meeting. Do you know what I mean? And that's what this program's about. That we look out for each other. That's what we do. You know what I mean? That's it, you know. And I mean, look how many Gooner friends you've made as well. You know what I mean? Not like Jeff. You know what I mean? Jeff as well, you know. Our mate Jeff, you know what I mean? Look at all these Arsenal fans you've made friends with in the programme. It's unbelievable. I haven't met a Birmingham City fan yet in the programme, so I haven't had to have that challenge quite yet. But, you know, and a lot of you on this meeting wonder what we're talking about. We're talking about our soccer teams, and we have a lot of tribalism in the UK when it comes to soccer. But, yeah, really good to hear you, Paul. Thank you, everybody, for, you know, having me on the meeting, and thanks for having Paul share this evening, because I just think it was really powerful, and I'll leave it there.
Thanks, Matt. Really appreciate that. I mean, me, myself, tonight in this meeting, I mean, I haven't been on Bournemouth for 4 weeks now, and it's kind of like getting a taste of Paul tonight is like something that I really, 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 really needed. And it was like I was really looking forward to it. And the beautiful thing about tonight as well is so many people thought it was a former Arsenal footballer coming on when they saw Paul M. But it's been a fantastic meeting, and I've really enjoyed the shares and everybody who's spoken on this meeting, particularly Paul, although he's a Tottenham fan, me being a West Ham fan, it's a bit difficult with that, but, you know, I can handle it. I won't hold anything against him being a Spurs fan. And we'll go to the end of the meeting if we can all come off mute.